Hey, I'm Dalton Ross, and welcome to the EW Morning Live podcast, where we bring you the best TV and movie interviews from our Entertainment Weekly morning show on Sirius XM. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at EWML Podcast, and get a little taste of what we offer every day on Sirius XM channel 105. With that said, now there's nothing to it but to get to it, so sit back and enjoy this week's edition of the EW Morning Live podcast.
This is EW Morning Live with Dalton Ross and Jessica Shaw on Entertainment Weekly Radio.
Welcome back to EW Morning Live. Dalton Ross here with you on Entertainment Weekly Radio, and very excited to have our next guest. He is the director and star of a really great movie about a really not-so-great movie, The Disaster Artist, which opens limited this Friday and then goes wide December 8th. James Franco's in studio. What's going on, man?
Good to be here.
Good to have you here, dude. I love bad movies.
You do? Oh, you do?
Something of a connoisseur.
I think so, like, you saw The Room a lot?
I have. I feel like
have you seen it with Tommy?
I have not.
Okay.
But I feel like there's
that's a whole experience.
He'll sell
you his underwear. They say YZO on the front in big letters. He'll do Q&As, and it's a whole thing.
I feel like there's like a holy trinity of like terrible movies. Oh.
What's your trinity?
Right,
what's your three?
It's Manos, The Hands of Fate, which is from like the 1960s.
Oh, wow.
It's made by
You go deeper than I know.
Dude, it's made by a fertilizer salesman in El Paso who
I gotta see this.
Soul crap.
I might have a couple that I could give it to you.
Okay, we're going to swap.
What's your other
one? Then there's Troll 2.
Yeah.
Which is classic.
Wait, classic.
Not a and sequel to Troll.
Has its... Exactly. No trolls in it. which has its own documentary, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And the dentist is the star,
it's
right?
So good.
Yeah.
And then there's The Room. And then there's The Room, which I guess is supposed to be like a sexual thriller, I guess, is the close... I mean,
what it was supposed to be is a Tennessee Williams-level drama, according to Tommy. Let me just throw a couple more.
Yeah, hit me.
I'll just add one more to that mix, which is Miami Connection.
Oh, it's the classic.
Yes. Although it hasn't been out long, right? Because the story of that is made in the 80s by a taekwondo instructor in Florida. Okay. It's insane. They are like rock, you know, they have a rock band, but they're like, you know, taekwondo good guys fighting bad guy ninjas that are, you know, stealing cocaine from the cocaine cowboys. And they wrote their own music, you know, like I think Best Friends is like one of the songs or something like that. incredible movie. But was made in the 80s. They released it in 8 theaters in Orlando when it came out. Like that was their distribution plan. And obviously didn't go anywhere. And then disappeared. And 30 years later, a guy from Alamo Drafthouse saw it on eBay, like the film reel, bought it for like $25 or something, and screened it, and they realized this is incredible, and they re-released it. So now it's out. But it's only been out for, I think, less than 10 years.
Yeah, less than that. Four years. I have the Blu-ray.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right, you're a master.
No, but the trailer is honestly one of the best trailers you've ever seen.
The master of bad movies.
It's incredible. Well, let's talk about this one. The Room, which your movie is about the making of this movement, and Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero, and based on his book. What is it? I mean, listen, there's lots of bad stuff that's just not, I can't watch this anymore. But there are these things that you and I are talking about that there's this just endearing appeal to it. Which The Room has. What is it about The Room that makes it so unique and made you want to sort of get into this?
This is why I think The Room, I mean, and Miami Connection has a little bit of this in it, in the sense that the guy that I think wrote that and financed it, YK Kim, put some of himself into it. But I think the secret sauce of The Room is that underneath all the horrible, weird creative decisions at every single turn, you know, is that Tommy Wiseau puts his heart and soul into this thing. And it's a incredibly, despite what he says now, because he's rewritten history, you know, and says he intended it to be comedy, but that it is an incredibly personal document of how he felt, you know, about how the world treated him, and that the basically he in the movie, spoiler alert, you know, it's not that hard, it's not that complicated. He is, you know, this Tommy cast himself as Johnny, this all-American guy, great guy. He work in bank, and he, you know, he's just, you know, the best guy, and he has a girlfriend, and his best friend Mark cheat on with his girlfriend, and then he kill himself. Spoiler alert. So that Tommy had felt rejected his whole life. And so if you just read that into, oh, his best friend and his girlfriend betraying him and feeling, you know, so upset about that he's going to kill himself, like, that's Tommy's story. I don't necessarily, and we say it in, you know, we kind of address it in my movie, like, I don't even know if it's necessarily like he was in a relationship that went sour. I think it's like his whole life like that. And that I think right before The Room, he made The Room. And this is one of the things that I just love about Tommy and makes him so endearing to me is I think he was incredibly depressed before he made The Room, and maybe possibly even suicidal. So when you think about that, next thing Greg knows, his buddy that is in The Room, and my brother plays in my movie, next thing Greg knows, Tommy showed up with the script for The Room coming out of this depression. And it was like, oh, he channeled everything, you know, instead of possibly killing himself in real life, he put it in the movie. And so when I look at that, I'm like, oh, I'm so moved, because The Room actually saved his life in a sense. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Not only did he need to make that because he had vision and, you know, he had a dream to make it in Hollywood, it was like, no, he channeled all of that depression into this thing. And I think people feel that. Like, if you go, you've been to the live screenings of the theatrical screenings of The Room. Yes, people are laughing at it. Yes, people are shouting things at the screen. But it's not necessarily like out and out cruel. You know what I mean? It's a communal thing. There's a different kind of energy there. And I think part of that is knowing that Tommy tried so hard. And there's, I don't know, I think everybody can sort of relate to, oh, I want to do something. And a lot of us don't do it. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, here's a guy that did it. Yeah, he fell flat on his face. And yes, we can laugh at it. But there's also something about, I don't know, like, it's like the old, you know, thing of the banana peel. Like, why do we laugh at somebody slipping on a banana peel? Because it's not us, you know? And so there's something that's like a little like reassuring about somebody falling so hard.
But you talk about his relatability, and it's interesting because you're obviously a guy that's had a lot of success, but you've also done a lot of things that, you know, people have said, what the hell is Franco doing? What is this all about?
Yeah.
Did that sort of,
yeah, I love that,
you know, and you've poked fun at it before, and This Is the End and stuff. And
yeah.
So is that something where you felt a connection
this
with
This Is the End
bit?
Was my room. That's basically The Room. We're all in one house, my house.
But I mean, is that something? I mean, there is something in all of us that can connect with that, I think, right?
Of what, putting yourself out there,
yeah,
or just trying things?
There,
yes,
yeah.
Yes. That is why I think that's what we really tried to hang my movie on. The Room was already this cult thing. You know, it was the new sort of Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yeah. Then the book came out 4 years ago, and when I read the book and understood the story behind it, I realized that it was this universal thing. It was something that I could relate to. It was the story of outsiders with a dream trying to make it into Hollywood or incredible, you know, fill in the blank, you know, a hard business or creative enterprise or whatever your dream is, and that everybody could identify with that. That was my story. I mean, my story parallels and crosses their story, not just like, you know, metaphorically, like, or, you know, as an analogy, but also actually, like, in the book, Greg Sestero, the other guy, and who also wrote the book, talks about going out and getting this other movie that maybe is even worse than The Room, called Retro Puppet Master. And he says in the book, long before he knew I ever wanted to make the movie or, you know, the book was out, James Franco auditioned for this and didn't get Retro Puppet Master. So, like, we were in L.A. at the same time, going out for the same thing, struggling at the same time. And Greg was actually beating me, at least for one role. and then what happened is I eventually played James Dean.
Right.
And Tommy Wiseau is a huge James Dean fan. And so I only learned later, but I guess he had watched my rendition of James Dean like many, many times. And so, like, in a weird way, this was my story in more ways than one.
Well, and playing Tommy Wiseau, this is a guy who, how do we put this? He keeps his past close to his vest. He does not like sharing information about himself, his age, where he's from.
The three mystery, yeah.
Where his money, from. Where the money comes from.
That's the scary one. Yeah, the money one.
That is scary.
Because he sounds like this, right? Which would suggest like Eastern Europe filtered through like whatever. But he say from New Orleans, the all-American guy, right? And so you don't know where he's from. He was at least in his late 40s when he made The Room, but he claimed he was in his 20s. And I mean, that's what's so beautiful. Like, those two things, he holds on to that facade so tightly, yeah. But it's like such a thin veil. You know what I mean? Like, he's not fooling anyone. And that's part of the magic of Tommy. Like, you haven't been to a screening where Tommy comes, but when he comes to those screenings, it's not like, oh, let's just be mean to Tommy. Like, people are so excited when he's there. And part of that, I think, is that he has taken on that persona and he's accepted, like, oh, I'm weird, crazy guy. And so he gives permission. Basically, he's giving permission for people to laugh. And it's this amazing thing that he's kind of done and capitalized on. Like, I like to think there's different Tommies. There's Tommy before The Room and Tommy after The Room. Before The Room, he was incredibly earnest, trying to make the great dramatic sexual thriller, I guess, as you called it. Whatever he was trying to, like, I guess that's what you could call any, you know, most Tennessee Williams plays.
Well, like, there's also, like, four sex scenes in the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Exactly. So he's exactly. Incredible. Exactly. Yeah. Repurposes footage from one and makes additional.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then there's a sex scene on the circular, you know, wooden stairs incredibly uncomfortable looking. And anyway, so he did all that. And then, so he was very earnest, but then, and had zero perspective on who he was or how he was coming off when he was making The Room, right? Because he thought he was James Dean and Marlon Brando.
That's it.
He, to the extent that he quotes Rebel Without a Cause, James Dean's film, in The Room. You're tearing me apart, Lisa, right? So then the Room comes out. People laugh at it. He had the wherewithal to capitalize on that. And when you go and watch the Troll 2 documentary, right? Remember they bring that director out from Italy. He goes to L.A. at the New Art. There's like a line around the block. Everybody's saying to him, hey, I love your movie, man. You're the director. Awesome. He goes in. They watch it. Lights come up and they do a Q&A. And that's the moment where he realizes, oh, they were laughing at it.
Yep.
And he can either accept that and maybe, you know, go with it, or basically say, you know, screw you. You don't, and that's kind of what he does. Yeah. Like, he says, like, I think he says, like, you guys are all crazy. Whereas Tommy went the other way, and he's like, oh, people want to laugh at a movie? Okay. Maybe I just tell them that I plan it that way. And so where he had zero perspective before The Room, he has become this maestro of marketing and capitalizing on the new life of The Room, so that it's been playing for 14 and a half years. I mean, I was just in London. It plays in London. It's the best audience for The Room in the world is in London. So, like, his movie plays around the whole world. And a lot of that, I think, is due to Tommy and his weird new genius.
He can't be at every screening. You need to now go to these screenings as Tommy, wearing the wig and the accent and the glasses.
I don't know. I can't help but do the voice. I love doing the voice. It's a part of me. It's actually sort of like a virus. Like, I feel like if I ever have to do an accent for a role, it just Tommy comes out now. Like, oh, this is my New York accent. This is my French accent. This is my German accent. It's just everything.
What's so funny about the how it was so, you know, the way that was produced, and they just threw scenes together and this, that, but your scenes of the scenes in The Disaster Artist are so faithfully recreated. You even at the end do a side by side. Like, you really took great pains to get those correct in how incorrect they were.
Yes, that was a whole thing. So we, in our film, you know, had to recreate scenes from The Room, and we, you know, because there's a scene where there's a premiere in the movie, and then we needed to have our version of The Room up on the screen, right? And so we had to match it shot for shot. What's funny is that Seth Rogen and I, who Seth's in it, and Seth and produced The Disaster Artist, Seth and I had actually had practice for doing that kind of thing, because we had recreated Kanye's Bound 2 video shot for shot. And, you know, Seth played Kim and I played Kanye. And we, when we started that, we were like, oh, we'll just do a few, you know, we'll do a minute of it or something. And then we got into, started doing it. We're like, oh, we can do the whole thing. And we could, like, get the lighting perfectly. It's just like a motorcycle and a green screen. We could do this whole thing. And so, like, we learned how to just, like, look at each shot, and the DP would, you know, figure out the lighting and get that exact. So when we went to do The Room, my DP, my cinematographer, Brandon Trost, like, he spent more time trying to figure out how they got their horrible lighting in The Room than he it's took amazing. Him to do his good lighting for our movie. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like, how did, is there a light on the floor, like, casting this horrible shadow? Like, you know, it was like a mad science project or something. And then, you know, the wardrobe would, you know, scour the thrift stores to get the perfect, you know, match on the costumes. And Chris Spellman, the production designer, like, watch The Room, you know, just watch The Room over and over. And there is actually behind the scenes footage of the making of The Room, like, yeah, hours of that. So he got, like, all the sets exact. And then the actors would just watch the, you know, they'd watch each shot. And it was like a song and a dance. And you just see, okay, all right, the hand moves there, the head cocks there. Yeah. Okay, you know what I mean? And we just did it exact. And then, anyway, so we didn't know that we were going to do the side by side, but once we were done with recreating all those things, and it was so fun too. It was like bonus. It was like when we finished our main shoot of the day, we'd be like, okay, we've got extra time. Now, which room scenes do we want to recreate? I think we have like, we might have like 20 to 25 minutes of recreated room scenes. It's not, they're definitely not all of what we have is in the movie. But we were so proud of it at the end. We're like, we got to do a side by side. But what we didn't, before was that we hadn't negotiated for the room footage. We had just negotiated for Tommy Wiseau's life rights, story, right? Yeah. So we had to go back to him and say, we want to use some of this room footage. Well, he had in his contract that he has a scene that we shoot a scene with him in the movie.
Right.
And it was, I was up for it. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted him in the movie. It would be like a little Hitchcock thing. But he kept insisting that it'd be a scene opposite me. And I tried to explain, Tommy, it's not going to make sense. I'm playing you, dude. It's not that kind of movie. And, like, I couldn't say, like, and you can't play anything other than yourself. Yeah. You'll always sound like you're, you know, like this from New Orleans, right? And so, anyway, we had shot that scene and cut it out. And so then when we went back to him for the race of the room footage, he's like, wow, you got to put my scene in the movie. And we're like, no, no, what do we do? And then we figured out, oh, we can just do like a Marvel style tag at the end of the credits. So there's this bizarro, and I mean with a capital B, bizarro scene at the end of the credits with Tommy.
Got to do whatever you got to do. It's so much fun, man. I loved it. I can't wait for people to check it out. It's The Disaster Artist, opens limited this Friday, then nationwide December 8th. Congrats, James. It's great. It's
thanks,
so
man.
Much fun.
Yeah, you're the dude to talk to about this.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. So good. All right, we'll be back with more on Entertainment Weekly Radio.
Thank you.
EW Morning Live with Dalton Ross and Jessica Shaw on Entertainment Weekly Radio.
Welcome back to EW Morning Live on Entertainment Weekly Radio, Sirius XM 105. I'm Jessica Shaw, here with Dalton Ross, and someone we've spoken about so many times because what an extraordinary career. Danny Elfman, composer, producer, just, I mean, genius, talent, Academy Award nominated, Emmy and Grammy winning. And I mean, most recently, you can hear his work on Justice League. And then coming up, if you happen to be on the East Coast, there's going to be December 6th and 7th at Barclays in Brooklyn, A Nightmare Before Christmas in concert. I'm going. I am so incredibly excited. Welcome, Danny Elfman.
Thank you. I'm really happy
and not,
to be here.
Not only is she going, but she's bringing her kids who are very young and haven't even seen the movie. This is going to be their first introduction to the movie, is pretty cool.
Nice. Okay.
So if they're scarred,
yeah, it's your
it's
fault.
Totally no, your
they
fault.
Won't
and
be,
it's all
they
on
won't
you.
Be. They won't be. That I promise.
Well, it's a movie that that I love, that Dalton loves. It's what's this like for you now preparing to do? Well, explain what it's going to be like. So the movie's going to be playing, but there's going to be live music.
The music is playing. I mean, the movie is playing, and we have a full orchestra and choir, and we have the original cast of people who sang, and we are going to do the entire score and all 10 of the songs live.
It's incredible.
Hopefully in sync with the picture.
How do you practice that?
It's tricky. It's very tricky. It's because Nightmare Before Christmas is one of those movies where the music is almost always going. And so to do it live, you've got maybe 30 cues of music. There's almost no place there's no place for the musicians to even pick up the next score and put it on their stand and turn pages. And the conductor has to really be on top of it. John Malciari is the conductor, and he's done a number of these shows. And I think there's only a handful of conductors who could ever actually pull it off. It's so complicated what he's doing. Now, we all just have to follow him. But
what are you doing?
I'm singing Jack Skellington.
Of course.
And also Lock, Shock, and Barrel. You know, so I have a couple other voices that I'll be doing. Mm-hmm. But you know, for me, it's just like reliving all these songs that I did. And it's funny because, you know, when I first started, the first thing I did with Tim was just like write them all really fast. And I did a demo where I did all the voices, but Sally on the demos. So now here I am like live on stage and still doing a bunch of the voices, you know, and it's I never thought I'd be doing this.
How have the rehearsals been going? Are you syncing up and everything?
Oh yeah. 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 And we've done it, 2 years at the Hollywood Bowl already.
Did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I think we have it down pretty well now. I did some of the songs live with this show called Elfman Burton, and we played a week at Lincoln Center, I think the year before last. And so it was clear to the producers that every time we got to the segment of that show, it's 15 suites of Tim Burton music, that we got the Nightmare Before Christmas, the crowd really came alive, and they said, let's just do the entire movie live.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Tim Burton. The collaboration that the two of you has had is, I think, one of the great like film collaborations when you've done. I mean, how many movies have you done with him now?
Well, I think this is 17. I'm just started. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. What was, I mean, did you
know? He's the one that sort of started you off on this whole journey,
yeah,
too,
did,
right?
He did start
him,
me off.
Pee-wee.
Yeah, Pee-wee's Big Adventure was the, I never wanted to or expected to be a film composer or get in even into that. So it was totally like, it just came out of nowhere.
How did that happen?
I mean, I got called in for a meeting with this young animator, and I knew who Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, was. So I was excited. I said, because I used to see like the live Pee-wee shows in Los Angeles when he first started. I even saw him with the Groundlings when Pee-wee was just one of several characters that he did. And so I thought, well, this will be cool. And they probably want a song because I was in a band. And I got together and so I'm thinking, like, what kind of song are you looking for? And he's like, I really kind of want you to write the score. And I'm like, why me? and he was like, I don't know. I think you could probably do a score. And I thought, he's crazy, but he showed me some scenes from the film, and I went home and I wrote a piece of music on my 4-track tape player.
Yes!
I made a demo, I did some overdubbing, and sent the tape in, and about a week later, I get a call from my manager saying, you got the gig. I go, what gig? Oh, that score for Pee Wee's Big Adventure. I said, oh, tell him I can't do it. He says, why? He says, because I don't know how to score a movie. I don't want to mess up their film. And so he says, you call him and tell him. I've been working on this all week. And I looked at the phone all this, and this never picked it up. So I did the score, and that was that. I've done 100 films later. I guess it was a good decision.
Right,
yeah,
I think
it worked out all right. What's it like when you work with him over and over? You have a lot of directors you work with, Sam Raimi and plenty of others. Is there just is it easier in terms of you having a better idea of what they're looking for, and you're not going to have a situation where the director's thinking one thing and you either can't figure out his vision, or he's not figuring out or she's not figuring out your vision, or anything like that?
Well, with some directors that would be the case, but not Tim Burton. Yeah. I actually never know what to expect. I mean, people have always said, "Oh, you've worked so many times with him, you must have shorthand." And I said, "We really don't." He'll show me the movie. We really don't talk about it a lot. Some directors really like to analyze and get into the backstory of everything and talk about their whole movie, what characters are thinking. Tim doesn't. He shows me the movie, and I'll just go off and start messing around with music. And when I have music, he'll start responding or not responding, and then I'll figure out what it is that he's responding to, but I never know what to expect. He always surprises me. A lot of themes of a lot of Tim Burton movies were not the cue that I thought he was going to like. It was the other one that I happen to have this choice too for this cue, because I'll usually write two or three things, and this might be the odd thing that I never really thought that he'd like. Oh, that's it. That's the one. So I never know what to expect with him.
That's so funny, because I feel like having, talked to him or seen interviews with him and everything, he's not, like you said, he's not like a super sharer where he's like, let's talk about every single thing. So you really have to...
No, he's not a deconstructor.
No.
He doesn't want to analyze stuff. He goes strictly on impulse and instinct. And so if there's no music to play him, there's really nothing to talk about with the music. He'll be opinionated once I've written a bunch of music.
Right.
But I just go out there and experiment, and I'll just give him choices, and then I'll see, no, he's not responding to that. Oh, really? Now this thing is really kind of lighting him up. And it's just like that.
It's so funny, because you're seeing the movie, obviously, with no score behind it, and the experience of a viewer is so impacted by the score. I can't even imagine hearing... Or watching a movie without those cues, because they are so much a part of the movie going experience.
Well, I mean, I guess if you're wired in such a way to become a film composer, which I didn't know that I was, you start hearing music in your head whenever you see a movie without music. So when I'm seeing a silent movie or musicless movie, hopefully I do start hearing stuff. And in fact, frequently when I see a movie for the first time, I used to carry a little tape recorder. Now I have my iPhone, and I'll stop a screening three or four times and run outside in the hallway and make notes.
Because open up GarageBand.
I don't want to lose my first thoughts, because those, not always, but sometimes, it's like that first thought is it. I mean, literally, and if I lose it, it becomes like the fish that got away. You forever will kick yourself of that thing. So
what's the film that you did that you had the hardest time cracking the code on?
The hardest film score for me ever, even after 100 films, was Batman.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? And,
because when Batman came out, it was only my 10th film, and I'd done all comedies. And so I was the quirky comedy guy.
Michael Keaton.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's
exactly.
True. Yeah. It's true.
But, Pee Wee's Big Adventure opened the door to virtually every quirky comedy made in Hollywood came to me. And then after Beetlejuice, it was now fantasy, it's opening up some more doors, but still quirky fantasy. Batman was neither, considered comedy nor quirky. And so I don't think anybody wanted me on the film except for Tim. I think the studio really wanted somebody more experienced, and I don't blame them.
They wanted a pop star, right?
Well, no, the producers wanted a pop star.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the studio would have been happy with any experienced composer. And I think the producer at that time really wanted a pop star. In fact, there was a point where they came to me and they really wanted me to collaborate on the score with Prince.
Right.
And the first version of the score that the producer wanted to do had Michael Jackson, Prince, and George Michael essentially doing the music. And when I asked, well, what would I do in there? And I would say, you'd be the captain of the ship. And I said, I don't like boats.
Great answer.
And yeah, I get really seasick. And so then it came down to, well, will you collaborate? And I said, like, I love Prince. I admire his music so much, but I will not collaborate on a score. And so I had to walk away from the project. It was really hard. Yeah. I actually had to leave the film for a while and let him do his thing.
Right.
And then got called back in. And that period of time was the worst ever in my film career, because I thought I just made the biggest mistake of my life. I've walked away from a career. But I knew in my head what the music should be. And I will never advise young composers to make the same decision for themselves, because they probably will destroy their careers. But I knew what it should be, and I decided to take a gamble and stick with it.
And you know, I've talked about that Batman film a lot, because there have been so many great Batman films since then that people forget. I honestly think that that's one of the most influential movies made over the past, you know, 30, however long many years it's been now, because that tone and that darkness for superhero movies really became the template. I mean, that was a huge, huge film.
Well, you know, the interesting thing with working all of Tim's early films, Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, Batman, Nightmare Before Christmas, and Edward Scissorhands, is there was nothing to go on. Musically, every one of those films I had, that there was no temp score, there was no suggestion of what kind of music to even play. There was nothing. And people forget, I think, in hindsight, in Batman, when I got it, there was no clue. The only superhero film I had to look at and go on was Superman. And we knew we did not want to make it sound John Williams heroic. I mean, that was a way to go, but this was just a very different film. And it's a unique experience, and one that I've not got to get, you know, out of 100 films. I've maybe had it 20 times, where I'm working on something where there's just nothing to start with. And for me, that's heaven. There's nothing better than that, than starting with nothing. And even with the Batman theme coming back around, it's like they say, well, that's kind of what you would do for that. I go, well, at the time, it was not obvious that that's what you do. I mean, we didn't know what to do. And the same on Edward, and the same on Beetlejuice. It's like nobody had a clue. Like, first off, what are these movies? And secondly, how the hell do you put music to them? It was really, in hindsight, just perfect.
But it's also interesting, you know, I wonder how it's different for you, even though obviously the Batman film franchise, you know, wasn't what it is now, you know, clearly. But they were characters that were, I mean, known and loved. So did you have a different relationship with that, because it wasn't like an original script with like completely new characters that you had to score their story?
But it was for me, because mm-hmm. I didn't have a sense of it. There was nothing I came in there with. The musical theme started to come to me when I, halfway through the movie, Tim usually would bring me on the set just to kind of walk around. And it really was at that halfway point, I was walking around on Gotham City set. And then the editor played me some footage, which was so dark I could barely see.
Yeah, right.
I mean, literally, when I was scoring the tower fight at the end, you know, they brightened it up a bit in the movie, but I couldn't even see who was hitting who. I was just going with sound. I heard a punch. I'm going to score that. And so it was something about the vibe of the set, and then the little bit of kind of dark footage that I saw in the, you know, rough assembly. And on the airplane on the way home, I started to kind of get the whole thing in my head. And it was kind of a funny story, because I didn't want to lose it. Again, it was one of these moments that it's like, oh, I got something in my head. And I know they're going to play a song when they land, because that's what they did back then. And it's going to erase everything in my mind. And I'm trying to hold on to this thing. It's a 10 and a half hour trip getting back to Los Angeles, and it's like, oh man, I'm not gonna hold. So I start taking out my little tape recorder, which I never went anywhere without, and I run into the bathroom because there's a guy sitting next to me, and I can't just start singing. So I'm starting to do notes, like like real simple stuff, like just here's a rhythm, here's like a French horn line, here's a counterpoint line, here's a second. And I was running into the bathroom about every 15 minutes. Now, every time I come out, I got more flight attendants looking at me. They're going, "Are you all right, sir?" "Yeah, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. I'm good, good. I'm really good, actually. Is there anything we can get you?" No, I'm really good. Okay. Clearly, you see, they're all talking. Everybody's looking concerned. This guy's on drugs. But he can't be like running in there and shooting up that many times, not every 10 or 15 minutes. It's like, it's not making sense to them. But I was in there every 10, 15 minutes for about two and a half hours. Until I had this catalog of like spoken notes and sung notes and rhythmic notes and everything I could possibly do to try to bring my mind back to what I was feeling this music was. And sure enough, the plane landed and it's like, all it takes is like 8 bars of Hey Jude.
Right.
And that's it. It's over.
It's done.
It's done.
Yeah.
And I got home and I take out the tape recorder. And in those days, it was on a 747. They're really noisy. The bathrooms were really noisy. You heard all this engine noise. And so all I'm hearing is,
yep.
And like, oh my God. But it was just enough. I caught some little hook of something that I was doing and it all came back. And it's like, oh, thank God.
Phew.
It was lucky. Because it was, in fact, what became the Batman theme. It wasn't just an idea. It was like the main theme of the film.
And coming full circle now, doing the music for Justice League, speaking of Batman. And, you know, Zack Snyder obviously directed that film, but had to come off the project, deal with some family stuff. So Joss Whedon steps in. So did you deal with Joss on this film then? Or
Yeah. I was dealing with Joss. And it was like, it's funny, I've only worked with him twice. Ultron and this.
Yeah.
And they were both like, are you available? Can you start tomorrow? And both times I was about to leave town. It's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's like bags packed. It's like, look, can you start tomorrow? And I happened to have a 12-year-old who was 10 when we did it, like Ultron. And I remember getting the call. I was going to Berlin the next day, Berlin Film Festival. And I got a call from my agent. He goes, "Are your bags packed?" "Yeah." "Unpack them." "No, I'm not unpacking them." "Well, I just got a call about a meeting for a film." "Well, great. I'll start, you know, when I get back." "No, can't wait. Has to be tomorrow." "I'm not meeting anybody tomorrow." And he says, "Remember how you were calling me, begging me for tickets to Age of Ultron for Oliver?"
Yep.
He says, "Well, I got you tickets, but you're going to have to work for it. You got to rescore a movie." And that was the first time. And then the second time, it was like, "Again, can you start tomorrow?" And I go, "Well, I wonder if what it's like working with Joss, where I have less than 24 hours.
Yeah, that's it.
Notice
exactly.
If we're starting on
you
the
see
film.
Joss calling, you're like, no.
Here we go again.
Well, tell us about, we're talking to Danny Elfman, by the way, just composer extraordinaire. And if you're in New York or East Coast, you can go see a live Nightmare Before Christmas at Barclays in Brooklyn, December 6th. And 7th, and Justice League now out in theaters. How was it, you know, revisiting the superhero world?
It was great. I mean, it was just kind of like, you know, it just reminds me, I used to go to Rome every year, and then I didn't go for a few years, then I went back to it, and it's still the beautiful city, and some things have changed, and there's new restaurants and stores, but it's still Rome. And it was kind of like the same way coming back to DC world, you know. It was like familiar territory, and yet, you know, I'm scoring in a different way, but I was allowed to touch base on their early DNA, and both Batman, obviously, but John Williams' theme for Superman, and for me, that was like such a delight. I got to take it and twist it around a little bit, and I could have done that forever, and so it was really a fun jigsaw puzzle. All these characters, each one has to have a musical motif, but then trying to give also a fresh theme for the entire group. And I love challenges and musical puzzles, so I really had a great time.
How do you write now? I mean, you said you used to carry around a tape recorder. And
I still do.
You still do?
Well, no, it's just called an iPhone.
Right.
Yeah. But I have notes even like from the middle of the night last night, you know, in the bathroom. Like, I ran in there and just started like, and I mean, this is for a piano quartet for the Berlin Philharmonic. It's not for a film. But I get ideas in the middle of the night, and I get ideas in cars and airplanes. Always at, like, odd times. And so I just always want something with me just to get a little bit of some sense of it. And so I'm always prepared. And generally, I'm always prepared at the worst possible time. I can't tell you how many thematic ideas or songs I started while driving. Because, you know, I live in L.A., so right. I drive a lot. And the car has actually become part of my creative process. Before I get in the car, I'll take a jump drive. I used to make a CD of like a dozen tracks, ideas I'm working on. I listen to them in the car. Mm. And I get, somehow taking it out of my studio and into the car gives me kind of fresh approaches. And then I'll start like kind of getting notes on top of that. So
I want to ask you about something involving you in film, but not your composing work, but rather some Oingo Boingo. Back to School. I need to ask you about Back to School. I've seen that movie a bazillion times. And of course, you guys play the big party scene. I need to know everything about filming that scene and any interactions you had with Rodney Dangerfield.
I mean, it was really just, you know, like shooting a movie scene. You walk up, you get in makeup, you know, you start doing playback. The fun part of it is the, you know, the engineer doing the playback who does the feedback that makes me wince on
right,
camera.
Right.
Of course, is Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. And, you know, I met him years later and didn't think he'd, you know, say, remember, I was with you Back to School. And, but it was just, I don't know, it was just weird, you know. I was uncomfortable. I'm always uncomfortable on camera.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like I was never meant to be an actor. I learned that really early on. You know, like,
but the music videos didn't make you more comfortable?
No.
You were in a band. How could you be? That's crazy to me.
I don't know. If a camera's rolling, I'm immediately uncomfortable. And
you look comfortable in the Weird Science video, I'd say.
Well, we shot it a bunch of times and we managed to get enough footage out of it that I guess, I don't know. I look at it and I just cringe. I'm just horrified, you know, the makeup and the whole thing. It's like, I can't look at it. So, but, you know, the past is the past. We can't just change it.
What's the
That's
one...
how it works.
That is how it works.
Yeah, as much as you'd like to.
I would like to.
Is there a score of a film that you wish you had written? Is there one that you think, oh, that is so perfect?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say what they are out of respect for the composers who did those scores that I wish I did. Because all composers, you know, we get jealous of other stuff. And, you know, there are directors who I would kill for, probably, to work with, but... You know, it is what it is, and I have to respect the process. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just dying to write, to open up and write all the time. That's why I started doing concert music. You know, and I'm doing a piece every year now where I could just like cut loose and let myself go crazy.
I mean, so many iconic scores that you've worked on. Is there one that you really hold dearest and truest to your heart? Maybe it's Pee-wee because it was your first one, or maybe it is the Batman experience. Is there one sort of score you worked on, like top to bottom, that really is sort of top of the chain for you?
Well, there's different movies for different reasons. Like Batman, because of struggle.
Right.
Because it was like this uphill battle. I had to convince everybody at every turn that, and I felt like I was barely clinging on by my fingernails every moment. And survived. So that's special. Edward Scissorhands for the opposite reason. In Edward Scissorhands, we were so under the radar. Nobody knew what we were doing. Nobody asked to hear any music. Nobody asked to approve anything. It's like, it seemed like they barely knew we were making the movie.
That's and so a beautiful score.
That was just really just, all right, I'm just writing and Tim's loving everything and there's no studio that wants to listen to anything that we're doing. So that was really special. And Nightmare, because... that was my first time ever doing a project like that, where I'm starting with the songs, ending with the score, 2 years of time going by, doing all these voices. I'd never done anything like that. So that also represented like a whole different mental everything for me. I mean, I'm used to being on a film for 8 to 12 weeks, not 2 years plus.
Right. And I hope you daily pat yourself on the back for the Simpsons theme.
Well, the Simpsons theme was just a lucky break. You know, I literally wrote it in the car in the way home from the meeting with Matt Groening.
That's pretty much the way he pitched it, too. Didn't he, like, literally write the characters, like, when he went in for his pitch meeting?
No, when he pitched it for me, he had a pencil sketch that was moving pencil sketch of the titles like you see them now. And it was enough to get a sense of, like, driving the car crazy. And it reminded me of, like, the Flintstones.
Yeah.
You know? And I said to them on the spot, I said, if you want something crazy retro, I'm your guy. Because that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
If you want something modern, right? And at that time, especially, like, modern TV themes were all boring to me.
Yeah.
I didn't like any of them. I said, if you want something modern, I'm not the guy, because it's going to be kind of jazzy and stupid. And And you know, he says, retro, cool, retro, cool. And I literally, by the time I drove home to my studio, it was all worked out in my head. I literally ran down to my studio, did a demo, took a couple hours, put it on a cassette tape, sent it to Matt, got a message the next day. Yeah, it's good. Let's go. Recorded it the next week. Now, you got to realize, I didn't think anybody would see The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I mean, like Nightmare, it was the kind of thing, or Batman,
right.
You know, I thought Batman would be a cult movie. I thought Nightmare, I didn't think anybody was going to understand. The Simpsons had no laugh track. It was so weird. I said, this is something people, it's going to run three or four times. It was purely for fun. No one's going to see it. I don't care. It's fun. I liked Matt. We had this weird history together. And so it was kind of like ironic that we were working together. You know, he used to be a music critic.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And
I forgot that.
So he worked
that.
For the LA Reader.
That's right.
And,
he did work
And he
for
reviewed
LA Reader.
One of my concerts, and he gave me this scathing review. Now, I didn't mind scathing reviews. I actually liked scathing reviews in a weird way. We sometimes even published them. But his review, he admitted that he was drunk and he was only there for the encores. And he described me as huffing and puffing my way through a song. So I wrote a letter back to them, and it was scathing in it. Rebuttal,
right.
And they printed it, and it was like, look, asshole, it's like, you could say whatever you want, but you have to show up for the show if you're gonna like have any opinion about it. And like, I'd like to see you how much you'd be huffing or puffing after you're on your 30th song in a row, and we don't do solos. So 30 songs for me is like singing for 30 songs. And and that was that. And we didn't speak for like another 12 years, and then suddenly 15 years later we're like in a room. And there he is, and there I am. It's like, begrudgingly, I was becoming a fan of his. You know, we did this, like, Life in Hell.
Yeah.
And I was like, God damn it, this asshole is really talented. And I hate it when assholes are talented.
Yeah.
And we're in the room, and he shows me this thing. I said, this looks great. And as we're leaving, he stops me and goes, I don't know if you remember. I said, I remember. And we shook hands, and that was it.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And it was just a lucky break. I mean, I literally just, there was no comedies that I'd ever seen at the time on TV that didn't have a laugh track. And just the fact
that
it was a weird comedic thing without a laugh track.
Yeah, Flintstones had a laugh track. Yeah.
Everything had a laugh track.
Yeah.
Every live or animated thing had a laugh track. Or what they call live studio laughter, which is enhanced laugh track, through a live studio. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
So it just seemed crazy to me. But I loved it. But it seemed like, you know, no one's going to see this. No way. And if I die now, that'll be on my gravestone.
That's it.
He wrote the Simpsons theme. Or it'll just be Homer going, doi, you know, and
don't,
don't. That'll be it. And on my gravestone, Danny Elfman, you know, if he died of state, don't. And, What can you do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's Simpsons amazing. Everything you've done, your collaborations with Tim Burton, extraordinary. So much. Justice League in theaters now, and if you're on the East Coast, go see A Nightmare Before Christmas in concert.
It's going to be fun.
With me and my family. Yeah. I cannot wait. Barclays Center in Brooklyn, December 6th and 7th. Danny Elfman, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much
for
joining
us.
Thanks, Danny.
I appreciate it.
And we'll be back on EW Morning Live.
What's this? What's this? There's color everywhere. What's this? There's white things in the air. What's this? I can't believe my eyes. I must be dreaming. Wake up, Jack. This isn't fair. What's this? What's this? What's this? There's something very wrong. What's this? There's people singing songs. What's this? The streets are lined with little creatures laughing. Everybody seems so happy. Have I possibly gone daffy? What is this? What's this?
For more TV and movie interviews sent right to you, subscribe to the EW Morning Live podcast on iTunes. And to get 24-hour entertainment news and views, check out Entertainment Weekly Radio at channel 105 on Sirius XM.